Greetings and welcome to the Virtus Investment Partners Capital Markets Overview. And as a reminder, this conference is being recorded Thursday, January 23rd, 2020. I'd now like to turn it over to Mr. Barry Mandinack, Executive Vice President and Head of Distribution at Virtus Investment Partners. Please go ahead, sir.
Okay, thank you, and welcome everybody to the Virtus Fourth Quarter Capital Markets Overview Discussion. Today's call will feature insights from Virtus's Chief Market Strategist, Joe Terranova. Joe represents Virtus as a client-facing thought leader, provides insights into the domestic and global investing landscape. He's also a CNBC ensemble member, appearing regularly on the Halftime Report, Squawk Box, and as a contributor of financial content across CNBC's media and digital platforms. Joe, welcome and thank you so much for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Barry, and good afternoon to everyone on the call. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedules to listen to Barry and I have a conversation about the capital markets.
Okay, great. Well, let's start off, we have this new decade upon us. So, Joe, if you could put on your hat as if you were in the wealth management business and advising private clients, what would be your playbook effectively for 2020? What would you say would be your three key objectives as you head into the new decade and into 2020?
Well, I always like to think of myself as being in the wealth management business because I have three little children, and those are the most important clients for all of us. So one of the things that I think is important, given where we are, as you mentioned, in going into a new decade, it is utilizing the word stay. And utilizing the word stay in three conditions. First and foremost, Barry, you and I have been talking about the importance the last couple of years of diversification in a portfolio. Stay diversified. That's incredibly important as we move into the new decade. And we're staying diversified not just by asset class. I think that's the mistake that a lot of investors make. We need to look beyond that. We need to look in terms of being diversified by geography. I think we need to be diversified by strategy, which is a new dynamic. What do I mean by being diversified by strategy? Over the last 3 years, Barry, growth has returned 106% S&P growth. S&P value has returned 17%. The strategies in the market have now gravitated towards more quantitative models. Momentum is more important than it was 10 years ago. Quality is more important than it was 10 years ago. So these are conditions that investors must incorporate in terms of wanting to be diversified. Going back to geography just for just 1 second, we all know about the lack of performance, relative performance for the emerging markets, 38% return over the last decade relative to the NASDAQ, which soared nearly 400% return. So that's a priority to me. Secondarily, beyond staying diversified, it's staying informed and receptive and understanding the tailwinds and the headwinds that can impact the market. And I think there has to be not so much a forecasting mechanism, which I think is a fool's game. I think you know me well enough to know I don't make predictions on where the S&P is going. What I do is I have a series of expectations, but we need to stay informed on those expectations. We need to understand that when you look back over the last 10 years and you give consideration to the annualized return for the S&P, it comes in somewhere around 13%. Well, the components of that return either come in the form of dividends, earning growth, or multiple expansion. You had a dividend contribution of around 2% in the last decade. You had multiple expansion of about 50 basis points, and then the remaining 10.5% of that annualized return came from earnings growth. Why did we see the United States experience record decade earnings growth relative to the rest of the world? Well, that was technology being presented as the new economy. So I need to stay informed. I need to be receptive to understanding technology's importance in the economy. Secondarily, as you and I have talked about, and I think everyone on the call understands, it's about liquidity and it's liquidity conditions. And the 180 in terms of monetary policy shift that we've seen from the Federal Reserve, we were removing liquidity from the marketplace, and that presented a liquidity crisis at the end of 2018. 2019, we put the liquidity back into the marketplace, and I would argue, Barry, you have a fertile liquidity environment that's consistent to what we saw in 2013, 14, and 15, when the S&P was the leading asset class in each of those years. what was the correlation? S&P takes its balance sheet from $2.7 trillion up to $4.5 trillion. We're witnessing the same thing right now, where the Federal Reserve is buying nearly $60 billion worth of Treasury paper in the repo market, and that's adding a significant amount of liquidity, and it's also allowing other global central banks to adopt easy monetary policy as well, and allowing the emerging markets time to heal and reflate. There's your geographic diversification. The third component of it, and I do this all the time, I think it's an incredibly important exercise, it's staying flexible, but staying flexible in the sense of understanding your risk tolerance. I think you and I had a conversation around Christmas, and I shared with you that I truly believe investor portfolios are like fingerprints. Each one is uniquely different. And one of the exercises I think would be important is take your portfolio, look at your portfolio for the upcoming year, and stress test it. Stress test it now in January. Same thing the Federal Reserve has done to the banks in prior years. Mark all your asset classes in a worst-case scenario. Mark them down and say to yourself, okay, am I going to be able to endure in that environment and possibly utilize rebalancing as an optimal strategy? I think that risk tolerance exercise is important given where asset classes are right now. So those three components of what I call stay diversified, stay informed and receptive, and stay flexible, understanding your risk tolerance. From a wealth management perspective, the three things, when I think of my three children, those are the three things I think going into 2020 are a priority.
Okay, and just to kind of reiterate what you said on the diversification, which I think is important, diversification to many people is stocks, bonds, cash. But you're saying you've got to go deeper in terms of geography and style and market cap, perhaps. Is that, I want to make sure I'm hearing that right.
Yeah, equity class size is a critical component of it as well. So we've heard so much about the last 10 years. Well, the last 10 years have been about mega large cap technology names and their growth. If I take the combined market cap of Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, and Google coming into 2010, it was somewhere around $700 billion. Well, that number is now well over or approaching $4.5 trillion. So it's the equity class size that's important as well. Just to emphasize your point on that class size, let's not forget about what we like to call the middle child, and that would be mid-caps. And there are so many mid-cap companies, okay, where growth opportunities are going to be found consistent with the earnings growth that I described for the overall S&P in the last 10 years. I think a lot of people misunderstand mid-caps, and they don't even realize some of the corporate names that are so relevant in our society today. As example, we think of Dunkin' brands. We think of Domino's Pizza. You're talking about companies with market caps, in the case of Dunkin', of $6 billion. You're talking about Domino's, a market cap of $11 billion. Barry, there's a name. It's a mid-cap name. It was the leading industrial in the S&P 500 last year. Think about that. A mid-cap was the leading industrial in the S&P 500. It's Copart. It's up 300% since 2017. It was up nearly 90%. So that equity class size diversification, to your point, is incredibly important. And look for the growth opportunities to come in that mid-cap space.
Okay, great, Joe. Thank you. Another topic which you kind of touched on, but I just want to drill down a little further. Equity valuations in the U.S. get a lot of press, talk a lot about the CAPE ratio being near or at historic highs, yields on fixed income are near historic lows. Given the current environment, many people are being told to expect muted returns from a traditional balanced portfolio over the next decade and could potentially benefit from added diversification outside in the form of like non-U.S. and emerging market exposure and allocations to alternative asset classes. For the many that tend to look in the rearview mirror and the 1, the 3, the 5, the 7, the 10-year numbers, they don't paint as compelling a case to be investing in emerging or international developed or alternative assets. What are your thoughts on that topic?
I think it's a great observation on your part. Let's first talk to let's go two areas. First, let's talk behavior, and then let's talk about actual strategies that we could be implementing in a portfolio. So let's think about the behavior first and foremost. Yeah, you rightly identify the expectation for muted returns. I think that's rather obvious to everyone. But the third exercise of what I began this conversation with was what's the risk tolerance? Stress test the portfolio, okay? Let's do that not just on a one-year basis, but let's do that over a 10-year period. I think that type of behavior is important because you have to understand that at some point you're going to endure a elevated volatility environment, and your ability to be diversified in that environment but also have the right emotional behavior to have a risk tolerance that aligns with allowing to you to endure, I think is incredibly important. I think, you know, you mentioned the CAPE ratio, and it's in terms of looking forward, it defines the environment, okay? But I don't think what it does for you is it specifically predicts a direction for the S&P. And let me share what I mean. I think a lot of people look at an elevated CAPE ratio and say, okay, a crash is coming. I don't necessarily know if I agree with that. I agree that it's a purposeful tool in understanding your expectations should be muted, but maybe what we should be doing, Barry, is muting our expectations for our portfolio on an annualized basis looking forward. And if you're basically expecting not much, I think you'll be okay in terms of what your performance will be, but I also think you'll be able to endure moments of volatility even more. And the last point on this volatility, everyone talks about an incredibly low volatility environment. What's even more compelling is the currency markets, which have a high degree of correlation to the direction of multi-assets. When you look right now at currency volatility is the lowest it has been ever on record. Last point on CAPE ratio. I like to look at CAPE ratio personally by sector. So I want to look at specific sectors and see where there's an elevation in the Shilla PE versus regular PE. Obviously, right now, if you look at energy, if you look at industrials, materials, you're seeing somewhat reasonable valuations when you compare the two. Expand that out further, communication services, real estate, technology, that's where you see the elevated levels, financial services to a certain extent. But I think what's interesting is healthcare. Healthcare, when you break out CAPE ratio on a sector basis, is kind of in line with where the overall PE is. So I want to look at that in terms of sector. Last thing what I said was my first talk about behavior. The second thing I want to do is give actual strategies. So if we're looking for alternatives in a muted world environment, I think one of the grand opportunities where alpha generation will be found is I talked before about mid-caps. Well, let's think about small caps, not just so much domestically, where we've had the benefit over the last couple of years from fiscal policy from President Trump's administration and the corporate tax cut and lifting of regulation. But now let's expand upon that. Let's go to the 25,000 companies internationally and in the emerging markets. On an alpha generation basis over the next 5 to 10 years, that's where I think the opportunity sourcing is. The emerging markets have experienced a contraction in earnings growth, but the one place it has not experienced the contraction has been in consumer discretionary. So that aligns with the possibility for there to be growth opportunities in those emerging markets, small caps and mid-cap companies. Lastly, private equity. Private equity, to me, look at the performance year-to-date of the Blackstones, the KKRs. Barry, I think you and I both can acknowledge there's been significant underperformance from the hedge fund community, okay? Private equity has kind of replaced the hedge fund strategy in terms of the alternative asset class. I think private equity is certainly a solution source in terms of strategy looking forward.
Okay. Joe, another question, a topic certainly very big in the wealth management world is the historic amounts of cash allocations on the sidelines. Cash coming into money market funds in 2019 was the highest it was since 2008. And obviously, you know, when you have clients dealing with longevity risk and needing to generate returns to prepare for a more dignified retirement, the paltry returns in money markets can be debilitating. What kind of guidance would you give to financial advisors about looking at their cash reserves? And certainly the there's always an appropriate amount of it depending on the client and their needs, but there may be some excess today given people's concerns about geopolitical risks, the length of the bull market, valuations, et cetera. What thoughts do you have around that?
I think it's one of the reasons why you're seeing mega large cap technology and this kind of passive index craze that we're experiencing, because what you're having is my experience with markets is when we say we're raising cash, okay, we're basically sitting idly and waiting for some form of alternative that's going to appear in terms of a new supply as an investable asset where we can get a less risky, okay, but a consistent return with what we would get in whether it be equities or bonds. Well, Barry, we haven't been able to find that. And I think what's happening is the, okay, just get me back in, that okay, just get me back in is going into passive indexing. It's going into those large mega cap companies. I see that as one of the catalysts for the rallies. But underneath that, I think the message, okay, is the need to stay invested. I think it's incredibly important. I think it is underscoring this supply-demand imbalance that we have right now for global assets. I've shared with you over the last 3 months in our conversations, if you look back over the last 12 years, we have not grown the supply of investable assets. In fact, we have diminished the supply of investable assets. 12 years ago, you and I were on this call, we'd be talking about commodities as an investable asset class. Well, we're not talking about commodities as an investable asset class because of the impact and disruption from technology. Demand, however, continues to grow for a limited supply of investable assets. And that underscores the priority and importance of staying invested and understanding your dollars are competing, okay, with other dollars in the search for yield. Your dollars are competing with the dollars that are going to come from the single greatest wealth transformation that we've experienced in the financial services industry. It's going to come from 75 to 80 million millennials, and behind them 75 to 80 million Gen Z. So the supply-demand imbalance dictates staying invested. Yes, there's going to be periods of volatility, but let's align our risk tolerance accordingly so we could endure those environments and utilize rebalancing as a tool, which I don't think people utilize often enough. And we had a conversation with Liz Ann Saunders yesterday, who worked for Marty Zweig, and I know you did as well at one time. And she emphasized the importance of having rebalancing in the toolkit for the investor portfolio.
Yeah, very, very important stuff there. You know, you touch on this active-passive dialogue, and I wanted to ask you about that in the context of your initial guidance about the importance of diversification. Within each asset class, an advisor could think about riding beta, if you will, or cheap beta, or active management. How would you guide an FA to be thinking about how to make those decisions?
So I would say when I look at it simplistically, and I think that's the way you have to do it, in a non-complicated capacity, the diversification and risk tolerance / risk management that I'm defining as being incredibly relevant, I just see it, Barry, as you're going to be successfully achieving your outcome with a active manager with a proven track record who has endured cycles, boom and bust cycles. I know that Bob Prince, the co-CIO of Bridgewater, said yesterday at the World Economic Forum in Davos that we've seen the end of boom bust cycles, but active managers and successful veteran ones, they've seen those boom bust cycles, and they know
how to measure the risk tolerance, and in non-equity asset classes, gosh, I see that as so incredibly important as we look forward. So to me, I look at it simplistically, and I look at that active manager, I look at the track record, I look at the experiences going through the boom-bust cycles, and ultimately, personally, I just think that's how I want to align myself accordingly.
Yeah, that's interesting. You mentioned Marty Zweig before. He always talked about, you know, the markets do what they have to inflict as much pain as possible on as many people as possible. When you think about potential surprises, both on the upside and the downside, what comes to mind from your perspective?
So I encourage everyone to read Bill Miller's letter today talking about 2019. I think Bill had a fantastic year. I think he returned somewhere around 120%. I said this on CNBC today. The interesting paragraph for me was where Bill talks about his market exposure in the fourth quarter and the position and strategy that he likes best is doing nothing. And he said what he did was he just sat back in the fourth quarter. He had crafted what his portfolio was going to look like, and he just allowed the portfolio to work. And he said doing nothing is sometimes the right strategy. And Barry, what I see right now is we all can see, the consensus can see the obvious. We all can see that this is a market that risk assets are in need of some form of a moderate correction. We all can see that, okay? That's obvious to all of us. The question becomes, and when I say stay informed and stay receptive, which of the tailwinds that we currently see in the marketplace are going to dissipate? Because that's where ultimately this impending correction will come from. It's not going to come from a headwind. It's not going to come from as people like to say, a known unknown. It's going to come from a change in the tailwind. So I would offer a couple things. Number one, I would say a very non-consensus call would be that the Federal Reserve would shift this easy monetary policy or begin to take away some of the liquidity they're providing to the markets in a presidential election year, which would be rather historic. Secondarily, I also think that a hint of inflation entering the economic picture, and by no means is there economic evidence to suggest that right now. There is not. But I would say economic evidence suggestive of inflation, I think that would be another perceived risk. But I think, you know, ultimately it comes down to getting back to where Bill Miller sits. And sometimes you're going to feel uncomfortable sitting with a portfolio that we look at and we say, well, gosh, there's a lot of risk potentially looking forward for this portfolio, but the right strategy is kind of just to sit with it and stay invested. And I think that's something that, given the environment we're in right now, I think that's incredibly important. And that's the negative consequence if you go against the proper behavior that the market is suggesting right now, which is to stay invested. Does that make sense?
Okay, I'm going to ask one final. That's great. I'm going to ask one final question before we open it up to the field for others. I read recently that Jeff Bezos was saying that he's often asked the question, "What's going to change in the next 10 years?" And he said he's never asked the question, "What's not going to change in the next 10 years?" And he thinks that's actually a more important question to be asking. So for the wealth managers out there who are trying to navigate people's financial futures and trying to think probabilistically about the future and understanding history as well, what aspects do you think are the things that we need to remember are not likely to change over the next 10 years?
First, globalization. I think there's a belief, whether it's a movement towards populism in UK or Brazil or Italy or, you know, obviously here in the United States, I don't think globalization changes. And I don't think globalization changes in terms of the investor impact. Secondarily, technology is going to continue to disrupt and improve sectors and industries. I believe that healthcare is yet to be disrupted by technology and benefit the consumer in terms of providing the transparency of pricing that has been visible in other sectors and the control of pricing that's been placed back in the consumer hands. I think healthcare is eventually the next source of disruption when I look at the sectors. But I think it's globalization more than anything else. And I will also tell you this. I believe millennials and Gen Z will be far more financially literate than any of the prior generations. I think people are miscalculating the contribution from millennials. I think there will be household formation. I think there'll be strong financial literacy, and I think that's going to curate a continued environment where there's competition for limited supply of investable assets, and in a low-yielding world, that's going to create a tremendous amount of demand and pressure on asset pricing themselves. And not negative pressure, okay, but positive pressure. It's unequivocal, Barry. The one place we're experiencing inflation, okay, beyond educational costs and some of the household components, is situated in asset prices. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. So I was going to say one of the things I think, given my experience, is unlikely to change in the next 10 years is investor behavior and the tendency to chase performance and oftentimes undo tomorrow's outcomes, an excessive reliance on past performance when we repeat every time that past performance is no guarantee of future results. And so the propensity for people to have behavior be the biggest obstacle, I think, is unlikely to change.
So can I ask you a quick question before we open it up to everyone on the line? If investor behavior improves, would you not agree that what we would be presented with is a less volatile market structure for global asset pricing, a more efficient market longer term, and a market that begins from a characteristic standpoint, the way it trades, to look somewhat similar to what we look like today? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would completely agree with that.
Okay, well, if that, therefore, is the case, then we better make sure that we're in these markets and we're giving consideration to each and every asset class in a portfolio.
Absolutely. Okay, well, with that, operator, I'd like to open it up to questions. Thank you, Joe, for that. That was great.
And if you'd like to register a question, you can press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone, and you'll hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. The first question is from the line of Jeff Jackson from Virtus. Please go ahead.
Hey, Joe. How are you, sir?
Hi, Jeff. How are you this afternoon?
I'm fine, thanks. And thank you to Barry as well for navigating the waters of your conversation. One of the issues that I confront out here in the field and just want to get your thoughts on it is about the massive amount of national debt, the impact on certain sectors of the bond market, and how do we address that moving forward, knowing full well that we need fixed income, but by the same token, don't want to be placing our clients in front of any unnecessary risk. Any thoughts on that?
Sure. The message from the Federal Reserve and from policymakers in Washington, D.C. is they hear you, they understand you, and that's why the rate structure is as low as it is. I also believe, looking forward, that you will begin to see, I know there's going to be some 20-year bond offerings, but I also think we'll be talking about 50-year bond offerings in the future, with the funds earmarked for specific needs in the economy, like infrastructure. I'm rather certain if we were to do a 50-year bond offering where the funds are earmarked for infrastructure, that people knew where it was specifically going in terms of rebuilding America's roads and bridges and tunnels, we'd see significant demand for it. So it's a warranted concern. It's a concern that's certainly not new. It's a concern that's, through the history of the last 40 years, has been with us. But the monetary policy of the last 10 years is somewhat assuaging those concerns. And again, as I highlighted before, it's when, tell me when you're going to see the dramatic shift in that policy. The only dramatic shift in that policy would be from rampant inflation. And the economic evidence is not there for it now. But as I highlighted before, that would be certainly a negative surprise.
Thank you.
And again, if there's any other questions, please press 1-4 now.
Love to get some questions from the advisors.
There's a question from line of Mike Warren from RBC. Please go ahead.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for doing the call. I always enjoy these. I know your experience way in the past, especially, was in the energy markets. And being someone who does invest in this area as well, I would love your take on what the price of oil is doing, and also what your take is on oil and gas pipelines as they've gone through this transition of restructuring their capital.
Mike, first of all, thanks for being the first advisor question. I appreciate your bravery. Listen, I've already highlighted the technological disruption that is benefiting our society. As it relates to domestic oil production increasing from horizontal drilling, I think we all at this point understand that. We've witnessed in the last 3 months two incidences that if we would have experienced them 15 to 20 years ago, the price of oil would be certainly around $150 in my estimation. You had an attack on a Saudi oil institution, and then you had the killing of an Iranian terrorist slash general operating in the Middle East. With a response from the Iranians that threatened potentially to escalate further. So, you know, price of oil sitting at 55 below where it was in each of these incidences, what's the message from that? The message from that is the reliance and the sensitivity to a portfolio to energy has dramatically lessened. So what do I mean by that? 10 years ago, 12 years ago, we were walking into the office. The first thing we were checking is the price of oil. Why? It impacted the portfolio. It impacted your conversation with your client. Now there's not that degree of emphasis. Do I believe that oil and natural gas, which is now below $2, we're talking about commodities that reach extinction? No, I don't believe in that at all. But I think the volatility, which I've highlighted here, and I like to highlight volatility in derivative markets like currencies and commodities, the volatility has been somewhat stripped out of that commodity space. The sensitivity to an investor portfolio has lessened. The overall weighting of energy in the S&P is now somewhere around 4%. Think about it. The entire market cap of the S&P energy sector is less than the market cap of Apple and Microsoft individually. Apple is bigger than the entire S&P energy sector by itself. Microsoft is bigger than the entire S&P energy sector by itself. Now, all that being said, I do think at some point, and one of the expectations for a second term for President Trump would be some form of infrastructure policy, and I think that comes in the form of a bond offering, and that infrastructure build-out would certainly be very beneficial to the energy transmission within the United States. And I think the pipelines would certainly benefit under those circumstances. So a non-volatile environment, I think, is what you could expect looking forward for pricing for crude oil and natural gas, a non-volatile environment with the potential benefit and blessing of some form of infrastructure fiscal policy that will benefit pipeline and transmission looking forward.
Thank you.
The next question is from line of Jonathan Karab with Wells Fargo. Please go ahead.
Joe, thanks for doing the call today. And I've been thinking about this. Scott Minard wrote a piece a couple of years ago about the Faustian bargain and about creating all the money supply and creating all these government securities and then buying them up themselves and creating all this liquidity as if there's no ultimate consequence. So far, we're seeing the benefit, as you mentioned, transition from tight money in 18 to easy money in 19, and look what the market did. But I just don't sense that that can continue on in perpetuity, and at some point, the piper has to be paid. And I know you're not trying to time it and see it, but it could be inflation, it could be a bunch of different things that shows up. And then ancillary to your other comments about 20-year and 50-year bonds, I wonder if you think that if that happens, that it's going to push up rates in general. So if somebody's buying 10-year bonds now and they can buy a 50-year bond, maybe there's less 10-year buyers, and so the rates go up on 10-year and not just on the 50-year?
That's accurate. I agree with your observation on that. Let me candidly say, with a 10-year sitting at 173, call it, more importantly, and I offer to everyone on the call, keep your eyes on what goes on in Europe. I still see Europe as in the least reflated geography, okay? I see the emerging markets potentially reflating. I see China potentially reflating. I see Japan potentially reflating. We don't see that in Europe, but follow those negative yields in Europe. Christine Lagarde has given indication she's going to look at that, but a German 10-year back to 30 basis points. I don't like where Treasuries sit today. I'd like to see, 50 basis points higher from here. That's indicative to me of a little bit more of a healthy economy. That's indicative to me of maybe a little bit more of a manufacturing recovery. We all understand right now manufacturing in this country is in a recessionary condition. We need to improve upon that dramatically. But I think for your question, it goes kind of back to what Barry was saying just in terms of behavior, and you used the word timing. Timing has been one of the worst strategies that an investor could have used over the last 10 years, and look no further than the hedge fund community. The hedge fund community is guilty of timing, and this has been in an environment where, because of the suppression of volatility, okay, the hedge fund community is underperforming because their beta assumption is higher than is necessary in a low volatility environment. And the same message can be signaled to investors. The beta assumption does not need to be as high as perceived to be given the low volatility environment. So the timing of when the removal of liquidity is going to come, I think will be well telegraphed by the Federal Reserve. I think markets will react negatively, just as they did in 2018. I think you're correct on that. I think markets will react negatively to when the removal will be. But as is often cited, I believe Alan Greenspan cited irrational exuberance in 96, and we still had some length in the runway.
4 years.
Yeah, we still had some length in the runway. So I don't like the word timing. You're right in every one of your observations. And for me, first and foremost, that removal of liquidity is the most incredibly important condition for all investors. And it's going to be a negative condition, no doubt about it. We got a glimpse of it in the fall of 2018.
So the decade of the 2010s, first decade on record, no recession.
Tranquil environment, no recession, no Yankee World Series. Look at geopolitical events, look at socioeconomic conditions. There's a high correlation I offer to all of you. Go back through the history of time. Think about the 60s,
Think about the assassinations of JFK, RFK, and MLK, the impact that it had on the markets. There's correlation between conditions, geopolitical conditions, socioeconomic conditions, and asset price performance. And looking back over the last 10 years, the conditions have been tranquil and favorable and conducive to asset price appreciation. But I'm certainly not smart enough to know when that is going to change.
Thank you.
Thanks for your question.
There's no other questions queued up at this time.
Joe, I will ask you another question, I think, that reiterates kind of what you're talking about, which is if you're a financial advisor today and you respect the law of market cycles and you understand that starting yields and valuations are terrible timing tools but valuable strategic tools for longer-term planning, it seems to me that many people might be thinking, it's a good time to be humble enough and open up to the possibilities that the next 10 years could very well be wonderful. And so you do want to stay invested, as you said, from the start. But given the backdrop of what I just mentioned, within the concept of staying invested, there are ranges of ways to be more aggressive and less aggressive within each asset class. And that idea and what goes on within passive investing, where in fixed income, aren't you really investing in indiscriminately in the most levered companies, the companies that are issuing the most debt, as opposed to necessarily the ones that are the most creditworthy? And so maybe it's time to be thinking a little bit more about allocations to passive and dialing back and diversifying within an asset class with some active managers that have more records of risk mitigation. Does that mindset resonate with you the way you're thinking, or no?
It does, but I need a first exercise. And I began the call by suggesting it, and it's something that in my prior life I did extensively, and that was take the portfolio. Take each and one of these asset classes that you're describing and stress test them. Put them through a scenario where they will be enduring now, okay, the potential volatility that looking forward we all expect is going to come. In that environment, given your personal circumstances, your financial needs, your goals over the next 5 to 10 years, will you be able to stay invested and opportunistically rebalance under those stressed conditions? If you will not, then I think you know pretty well where you sit right now in the portfolio and what you need to be doing. But to me, that's the first exercise that's rather relevant.
Yeah. Well, sir, we'll close with that then. And I think what you're saying, if I'm hearing you correctly, is, as you said earlier, each portfolio is dependent on the individual. And the best portfolio is ultimately the one that a real client can stick with through thick and thin. Right?
Client can stick through and also can look back upon, most importantly, and say, okay, we defined a set of objectives and goals, and how many of those did we achieve, despite whatever the market might have done?
Yeah.
That's success.
Well, sure. Thank you, Joe. We appreciate your time and sharing your insights, your observations. What I'd like to right now do is thank everybody for taking the time of your day. I know everybody's busy to hear from Joe and hear about the Capital Markets Review. For additional market commentary and portfolio-specific insights, please don't hesitate to visit us at virtus.com. And if you have any additional questions or would like any further information, please feel free to give us a call at 1-800-243-4361. That's 1-800-243-4361. Joe, I want to thank you again for your time today, and thanks again for everybody's time as well. Have a great evening, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
That does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation, and you can now disconnect your lines.